All right,
Hello.
there's
Good
Randall.
evening.
Hello.
How you doing?
This is Mike from Sly Flourish.
Mike,
oh.
How you doing, man?
Mike,
I'm
you
doing
sound,
very well.
You sound
good
great.
Hey, Mike, can you say this is Mike from Sly Flourish, and you are listening to the Dungeon Masters Roundtable podcast?
Sure, right now.
Which
sure, go ahead.
And what is it called again?
The DM's Roundtable.
Hi, this is Mike. Should I do okay. While you are all laughing at me?
Yeah, totally.
Yes, absolutely.
This is Mike from SlyFlourish.com, and you're listening to the DM Roundtable.
Are you?
I get that right.
Mike, are you drunk? Are you drunk like I am right now? Or
no, I'm fully sober.
Oh man.
Well, one of us has to be.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
I am.
The funny thing
I like
about
the little
that
question
is
question at the end. Yeah. DM Roundtable.
Roundtable.
Yeah.
I think maybe I'm there. This doesn't sound right. Well, yeah, the crazy thing is we don't even do intros, so, you know.
Yeah, you put me on the
well,
spot.
What's funny is talking. I did – what's funny is I did intros for the sort of impromptu session I did last week because – and then in the intro I said, well, you know, you may not recognize these voices because they're not the normal hosts, so introduce yourselves. But then I – afterwards when I was listening to it, I realized we never introduced ourselves in the first place. So
yeah, I had no idea when I was listening. I kind of didn't mind, but
– oh well.
No, that's kind of the assumption is that we're all celebrity enough that you should know our voices by now, right? I mean, you know,
that's the conceit. Yes.
Well,
oh, conceit, right? I get this.
Is that he's drunk enough that he thinks that everybody should know his voice.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. This is really cool.
Oh, you're welcome, well, man. You've been around for a while.
Yeah.
You're one of the good guys.
Yeah.
Hey, congrats on the new book.
Oh, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not here to pimp the book. Yeah. I'm just here because I like the show.
Well, yeah. No,
no one should, though, because, I mean, yeah, pimp the book. Because, you know,
no one really pimps anything on.
I don't mean to pimp my book at slyflourish.com/book. $7.99 in PDF.
That's awesome.
And EPUB. $11.99 in hard copy.
See, Thaddeus, you can take lessons in pimping from him, I think.
Yeah,
see,
mine was the best thing he has ever read.
Mine is simple. Mine is just buy my shirt. I mean, I don't really go for anything more complicated than that. Just buy my shirts.
That'll work.
Yeah, you know, it's easy. MyDNDGameNet.com/store. You know, that kind of stuff.
We could just sit here spouting out URLs for now.
Yeah.
So how is gaming this week for everybody?
It's good. I got a game tomorrow. We've been off for 2 weeks. I'm really excited. I've been jonesing.
Are you the DM or are you a are you a player in it?
No, I have a local RPGA game that I play in about once a week. But then I have a Wednesday game that I've been running for about 2.5 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We've never missed more than 1 week at a time. And then we just missed two because everybody was away. And
oh wow!
Crazy.
Wow. That.
Okay. Everybody, stop for a second. I gotta ask this then, because I've never really played in an RPGA game. I guess unless Encounters counts. But how is that? I mean, is it really as rule intensive as everybody says, or is there leeway for the dungeon master to kind of make changes? Or
you know, there's an I think there's I so I've run one RPGA game myself, and I took as much leeway as I want. I think that there's more freedom than a lot of DMs expect and a lot of DMs will assume. So more than once I've had DMs who say, oh yeah, well, that's kind of the way the module is written. And you're like, well, you're in control of the table. You can do whatever you want. No one's going to tell on you. There's no online system. You're not going to get in trouble. If the game's not paced right, change the pace.
Okay.
But,
I mean, I've always spoken boldly about, you know, kind of rules being more for RPGA and breaking the rules is more for home games. But the honest thing is I've always been talking out my ass because I've never really played in an RPGA game before.
You know, Thaddeus, I'm recording this and I can cut that little clip out where you said you're always talking out your ass. we can put that at the beginning of the intro of every DM Roundtable.
Yeah. Well, luckily we don't do intros for the roundtables, so.
Well, not until now.
You need to get the cool beep sound, so you know.
Yeah.
I haven't really been playing much in a lot of RPGA games, but I thought there was, I had read about something where they were building more modular modules where you could kind of, the DM could kind of change things around and move the story structure around. And I thought that sounded like a pretty good idea. I mean, that's what I do with normal modules anyway. But I never really saw that in action. I just saw people that ran modules right off the page.
Mike, what's the campaign setting that you're
for
using?
LFR?
For
RPGA?
For the RPGA, yeah.
Yeah, it's Living Forgotten Realms. And it's as full and as rich as the Forgotten Realms is. So there, and I mean, my Forgotten Realms ended about, I don't know, 16 years ago. So the new Forgotten Realms, I don't know. I don't have any idea what's going on. And my character doesn't care. He's a dwarf who hits stuff with a hammer. So he really doesn't get into the political intricacies of Shar and the Zinterim.
Elminster, who's that?
Yeah, you know? Whatever. You know, just let me hit something with my hammer. Which nice. Can be bad because some of the modules have a lot of story going and a lot of people are really interested and I'm kind of staring at the ceiling waiting for the next battle to start.
Nice.
Now, they just did a format to their Living Forgotten Realms or their...
Yeah, Wizards... Well, and I'm going to butcher this. You know, I don't go look up on the internet for the actual truth, but what I understand is they... Wizards has kind of disassociated itself from LFR and from Living Forgotten Realms, which is the RPGA setting. And they're kind of letting it be run by the community now. So some people think that's really good. Some people think that it's not good. I think we'll have to see how the quality of the adventures comes out. That's kind of all I care about is how good are the adventures.
Now, see,
wait. You mean there's disagreement in the community? No way.
Yeah, oh, shocking. No. Now, right. See, everybody seems so shocked that change to the more community-driven thing was coming.
Yeah.
But, I listened to the podcast from, D&D Experience this year? Mm-hmm. And they basically announced that in the RPGA conference thing that they did,
right.
They basically said we're moving to a more community driven LFR setting, and
well,
so
they're kind of like, you know, the woman who breaks up with a guy by buying him an apartment, and you know, all his stuff. Like, oh, I'll move in too, just not right away. So I think that they were kind of saying, yeah, we wanted to kind of step back and let the community really run it, and I think that they're doing it. They, you know, Wizards seems really focused on D&D encounters. And that seems to be where they're pushing their big drive. That when you look at the production value of the kits that they sent to DMs, it's far higher than anything that the RPGA has really gotten, where you have to print off your own adventure with whatever ink cost that's going to be and do your own maps and everything. And maybe some of them will be using dungeon tiles and maybe you'll happen to have those dungeon tiles. But with D&D Experience, you get a full map and you get character cards and you get, you know, everything that you need to run the game. So it's clear where Wizards is putting their focus.
Encounters was definitely designed to bring new players in, which any business is going to want that. And LFR was kind of a keep the existing players happy kind of a setting. And
yeah, I really love the idea of D&D Encounters, but my first D&D Encounters experience wasn't exactly selling me on the whole format where I drove 30 minutes there and 30 minutes back to have two rounds of combat.
Ouch.
I was wondering about the encounters. I'll say right up front, I have not played one. I don't. Unfortunately, there's not a venue here in the town where I live that has it. Where I would be happy to run it, but there is no venue. I've been wondering if it's too encounter based. I mean, I know the name is D&D Encounters, so you expect to get a fight, right? But for me, 80% of the game is the story and the campaign and the reason and the morale and the ethical questions and the sort of role playing aspects of it. I mean, my game that I run tends to not be focused as much on battle.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that's the way to bring new players in, and then, but what happens to them, to those new players? Do they learn that, okay, D&D is really all about combat and there's not really a lot of story and here's how you play it? Are they learning that there is some story to it?
I can't speak for the Dark Sun season, the one that's going on right now, but I played in 11 of the 12 sessions for the first season, and that's pretty much exactly what it ended up coming about. There was a loose framework of a story, and some encounters had more story than others, but the focus really was around the combat every week. I think there was one exception, which was there was two skill challenges, but even that one, they had an optional combat encounter, and almost everybody ran that I heard, because otherwise the session was like 15 or 20 minutes, if that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I only played the one Dark Sun one, but the Dark Sun one had a skill challenge that was kind of wrapped around the combat. So there was definitely a story there, and there was definitely a setting. It wasn't real rich. Okay. I mean, they're handing you a 5x8 card that's got your character on it, so it's not like you're
right. Not
a real deep background. But
not to come off in defense of, you know, Wizards of the Coast, because I don't feel that they need someone to defend them. I think they're doing pretty good on their own. But when you try to get a bunch of players who have never played Dungeons and Dragons together, and you're saying, you know, you're like, okay, now role play for 2 hours.
Yeah.
I think combat is the one thing they know they can fall back on, that, you know, these guys have all played video games or some other role playing game before, and they know combat. You know, when you're
going to draw people in.
Yeah. When you ask somebody, sorry, I'm slurring so bad right now. Ugh. oh man, it's gonna take a little while. Maybe by the end of the podcast I'll be all right.
Let me cut you off though, because what you're describing I don't disagree with, but
only cut me off if you're gonna tell me that I have the greatest music video ever. But
you have the greatest music video but ever.
Thanks.
I'm gonna let you finish, but
no, seriously though, I understand that the combat is what's bringing people in, and it's the thing that people understand. But where do those players go that they've now been introduced to this system? Where do they go after the encounters? I mean, I feel you on that.
I think maybe there should be a kind of a post encounters packet that goes out to the DMs, like, you know, or maybe there should be a final encounter or something.
I don't think they're expecting that the DMs are new.
Tracy wants to say something, and we usually push her out of the way. So let's.
Yeah. So, well, first, I have a friend here who is running the first season of D&D Encounters in the Boston area, and he actually started up a campaign afterwards for the new players that he had introduced to D&D through the Encounters program, and they're playing every 2 weeks a game, just a regular D&D game with story and everything else. The other thing is, I know story is great. I love story, but I really like combat. And if you want,
you're
that,
very Tracy is very tactical.
I am a very tactical player, and we tried. So my very first game was right outside the waterfall in Keep on the Shadowfell, mm-hmm. and they tried to.
Yeah, that's
to,
a brutal fight.
Yeah, it was awesome, but I got surrounded right away. And bloodied and almost died, but it was great. Everyone came to my rescue, and I got better, and I learned quickly the type of tactics you need to play this game. But we tried to do the role-playing thing, and I sucked at it. I couldn't speak. I just blanked out. I was like, I have no idea what to do here. Let's just play combat. I know the rules for that. I can do that. I can't make up a story on the spot right now.
Right.
So I think... I know for people who are very into story, it can be kind of jarring to think of, was it 12 weeks? I forget exactly how long.
Yeah, last season was 12 weeks. I think this is 14.
Yeah. Trying to have a game for that long where it's focused on encounters. But the other problem is that you have people coming in and out, and it becomes very hard to keep a story going for that long. Yeah.
True.
If the same people aren't showing up every week.
Very true. We started right in the middle of it and kind of said, okay, we're in a caravan and we're getting attacked by lizards.
Maybe Wizards of the Coast could on the next encounters. Well, I guess they've already kind of have the next encounters designed and they're playtesting right now, but maybe the one after the next encounters, they could start to look at, okay, we've drawn in new players for encounters. Why don't we set up a system where we now draw in new players and new DMs, because then at the end of encounters, just like Tracy's friend is doing, you would have a brand new DM who doesn't have a party and a brand new party who doesn't have a DM all playing together for 12 or 14 weeks. You would have brand new D&D groups suddenly, bam, there you go. You've got a DM. He just learned how to DM through the Encounters program. You've got new players. They've just learned how to play through the Encounters program. Now they all go off together, and they experience 4E in the entirety together.
Or yeah, I mean, I think they said that they really – I think it was when the DMG 2 came out, and they used to – they had a D&D game day where they tried to train DMs. You know, they had brand new people that were acting as the dungeon master for the games they were running. And they said that, you know, the way their marketing group looks at it is that the DMs are the lifeblood. The DMs are who you're selling it to. And, you know, they are the ones who draw players in. You know, that if you can get the DMs in, then they'll get the players in. And I don't know if that's still true because there's so many player books out compared to so many DM books. But
no, it's true. It's true. In fact, that's one of the things that we sort of touched on in the 4Geeks 4E podcast that we recorded earlier, is that...
Earlier, 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, 15 minutes ago. Dungeon Masters, you know, you can't have a game without a Dungeon Master. You know, if you're a Dungeon Master, for example, okay, I live in Ithaca, and I'm a PhD student at Cornell University. And if I go on to the listserv, the game club listserv for Cornell, and I just... put one message out there that says, hey, I'm a dungeon master and I'm looking to start a game. You know, and in fact, that's what I did 2 years ago. I got like 15 responses within an hour.
Yeah.
But, and then I got my group together. And now in the past year, there have been at least 10 emails from, you know, just random new players that are coming into the area that are looking for a game that they don't DM. Right. They just need a game. So, right. You know, you always need to be building up the DM foundation because otherwise you're not going to have.
Yeah, we have all the power.
Right, exactly. We do.
I think, though, that
as it should be,
having people start out as their first DM experience being something like Encounters or an RPGA event is incredibly difficult and probably isn't going to happen very often, just because a lot of times it's complete strangers and nobody has that. Very few people have the confidence to start out that way. Usually, a first-time DM is going to want to DM it in front of their friends, or at least have their friends be the majority of the group.
I'll tell you what might do it is the new Ravenloft board game.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, that board game has no DM. So you could have four people that are sitting around playing that board game over and over, and one of those four people might start to pick up and start to look at it from the storytelling perspective and realize, I'd like to do this, but I'd like to do it a little bit differently. And now suddenly a DM kind of spawns out of a group of four that have been playing together for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe potential.
Yeah. I am stoked about that.
No, what I was going to say about the Ravenloft game, though, is that unless there are hooks within the game itself that, you know, to experience this further, you need to check out this, then that's not – I don't know if that will work. I mean, we all sat around playing dungeon game back in the 80s and that, you know – I liked DM, but I didn't start DMing till 2000. So, you know, it was – I'm not sure if just the game itself will do it unless there's something built into the game that encourages that spark that says, oh, I want to now develop – you know, I want to look at the story end aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, somehow there were DMs that were created with the red box. So I think it'll work itself out one way or the other.
Yeah, I think Mike has a point in the fact that you get a bunch of people together who are playing – and then at some point they're like, well, I don't really want this to end. You know, I want this story to continue, but this board game is really limited in what it gives us, and it's going to be another 8 or 9 months before there's another board game we can play. So
I could get D&D Essentials.
Right. I could go buy this brand new red box that they're putting out, which I guess maybe that's part of their whole marketing scheme is, if they're thinking the same way Mike is, then, you know, I can go buy this red box and we could be playing another adventure in no time flat and it'd be a little different because I'd be running it, but you know,
yeah, solo adventures and everything else. So you can practice on your own.
Get the mechanics. Exactly. Exactly. I think you've struck a pretty good point on
I have a feeling they had this point. They don't need my ass figuring out their marketing.
Yeah. And I've heard that, Gen Con, it's going to be the red box for the learn to play sessions.
Right. That'd be pretty cool. I'm really
looking no kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. God, really, I wish I could.
Well, that's what you're running, right?
Yeah.
Hey, when do they announce that that the winners of their Never Split the Party contest? Because I actually entered the Fellowship of the Tweets into that. So I'd love to find out if we won or not. Anybody know?
I have no idea.
I don't remember.
I have no idea.
Oh, a lot of help. You guys are supposed to be like the people in the know for this stuff. No help there. Okay. I'm just going to go check out
the website. I hit Wizards site maybe twice a week, man.
Yeah. I watch the RSS feed, but I don't really go there very often.
Yeah, that's same.
I go there when they put out an update, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, me too. I don't hang out on the community pages though, cuz I would spend like all day reading the forums and I don't have time for that.
I'm not
I can't read the forums there. I get too angry.
Yeah, I don't find the quality, not to be an elitist snob, but here I am.
But here you're going to do it.
Yeah, here, watch me as I become one.
Mike, you're at the DM roundtable. Being an elitist snob is
elitist snobs.
Hey.
I don't find the quality of their messages as high as what I find on NWorld.
Sadly, it says winners will be selected and notified by July 12th. So since I never heard anything from them, that means that we probably didn't win, guys. Sorry.
Well, you know why that is. You know why? It's because my dwarven brethren got eaten by ghouls. And so you cannot reunite a party that has no other dwarf. I'm sorry. You just can't do it.
Well,
I'm getting choked up here, man.
Yeah, that's too bad. I feel bad for Toma, but Chilean really doesn't mind that there's one less person in the party since he just got some pretty fat loot.
Did you guys take a look at the update? Did you guys already talk about the update?
Which update? Wait, what are you talking about?
The most recent Wizards of the Coast update with the new magic missile and all that.
Oh, yeah. We covered that last week in two
seconds. But you know what? I wasn't there, so...
How about the damage tables? Did you guys talk about that?
If you have something to say about it, please bring it up.
I brought up the new monster tables, and they didn't seem interested in it. I don't know why. They are DMs, and it was
I spent my entire weekend with that table.
Yeah, I had to go back and go over all my monsters that I created recently.
Yeah.
I was busy whining about Magic Missile, which then later DM...
I don't care. That's a player thing.
Aaron over here, who came on in a quote-unquote special edition podcast, decided to call me a whiny little bitch without naming my name.
Call you a whiny little bitch.
Yeah, you called everyone who talked about it a whiny
little bitch. I don't know. With 2,000 powers out there, I find it hard to get excited about one.
Well, I mean, to be honest...
The
monster damage tables never really crossed my path because I have been editing monsters since the beginning of my DMing career. Okay. Just because I've never really been interested in the 3-hour combat. And you know, one of my most angry posts on my website, mydndgame.net, has been was about an encounter I was in that lasted like 4 freaking hours that I just the whole time I was just waiting for it to end so we could get back to the real game. And ever since then, I have been cutting my monsters down. You know, their hit points, I cut them in half. And I add, you know, an extra D8 or a D10 to their damage. They hit hard and they go down fast, which, you know, my players...
What tier? First,
heroic. I've never had a party leave heroic tier, sadly. Right. I hate to say that, you know. I call myself some kind of awesome DM, but I've never had players
let's stay in heroic all the time. I'll tell you, I think heroic is where the game shines.
Yeah, well, it's really sweet spot for a lot of people, but I'd love to be able to take a game past that at some point. But
I mean, there's great fun things at Paragon and heroic, but when it comes to watching the mechanics work right, I think that heroic is where it's really balanced, and I think when you get into Paragon and Epic, things start to get out of hand pretty quick.
And I think, Paragon and Epic are where the DM really need to take things into their own hands and make them work.
Absolutely.
But for heroic, I've really spent a lot of time cutting, you know, hit points in half, damage increasing. So suddenly monsters have threat, but combat doesn't last that long. And really that's something I learned from, you know, playing with the Fellowship of the Tweets with newbie DM. You know, we got in combat with an ogre and he went down pretty quick. But he also beat the crap out of I think Randall was our tank in that game. And
no, that was me. Gar Strongstone took so much damage we had to go back to town and rest for a week.
Yeah. And I mean
that was the first game before I joined.
He, you know, Gar really got smacked around. And it only took three rounds to drop the ogre. You know, it was only a 15-20 minute combat. but there was a lot of threat there, and there was.
Did he house rule it?
No, it was straight out of the. It was original D&D, so it was
OD&D.
Straight out of the red box, and there was. I mean, there was some heart pounding action. Like, oh crap, Gar's down to like 3 hit points. We don't have a cleric. No one's healing this guy. If he drops, you know, there's no resurrection. So we had to drop the guy quick, or get out of town. And I really kind of carried that into my D&D game, which is I haven't had a combat go over, you know, 60 minutes these days because and my players love it because we get back into the story. They get, you know, in a 3-hour encounter, they get 3, 4, 5 combats and they get a lot of story, which I kind of feel really brings the heart of D&D, which is exploration and you know, high adventure in an unknown land into the center of the story instead of 4 hours of combat and 20 minutes of role play. So
right.
So do you have a lot of tactical players in your group, or do they not like tactics?
I have 2 guys who are really tactical, but at the same time, they're 2 guys who are really into story. So if tactics doesn't really work its way in, then...
See, I have 5 players. 4 of them are extremely tactical. And I do the same thing you do, and I've been doing it for about 1.5 years. Since after about 3 months of playing, I decided I wanted the combats to be way shorter. And the very first thing I did was cut hit points in half and increase damage. And
okay, I'm gonna stop you there for a second.
Yeah.
Not really. I'm just gonna go pee, so I'm not gonna say anything for a while. It's not.
You gonna tell me I have a nice butt?
No, you have video. No, man, you have the greatest. Website out there right now, though. I just want to let you know that. But I'm going to let you get back to it in a second. I'm going to go first. I'll be back.
Anyway. so the very first combat after I made those changes, the players were like, oh my God, you know, we must be fighting this really powerful creature because he just hit me and he did this ton of damage and that's never happened before. But what it did was it actually really sped it up. But now that it's been a 1.5 years, they're sort of used to that. And so they know that the creatures are – you know, really cannons. Powerful and but you know, the tacticians in the party, you know, every once in a while I throw in a combat that takes a lot of tactics to make them happy, because if I didn't, all these quick combats would sort of, you know, they wouldn't be very happy. And for me, the point is everybody needs to be having fun. So, you know, I pretty much tweak everything, but that's also the reason I didn't look at the new damage table, because I always tweak it anyway. So
right. Yeah, I mean, I've been tweaking damage since my group hit level, I don't know, 12 or 13, and they started just eating guys alive.
Yeah.
And I'd been modifying damage ever since. And I played with like 3/4 hit point and, you know, double their static damage bonus, which turns out to be actually the math that they use is pretty close to that. If you double the static bonus or triple the static bonus that they've got, you get pretty close to what their math is like now.
Right.
But they
went through an evolution too as well. I mean, because the Monster Manual 3 is very different from Monster Manual 1.
Right.
And I think they're improving as they go. So,
Right. Well, I think they're seeing a lot more groups that are running at the Paragon and Epic tier. Uh-huh. And they're seeing what happens to our poor monsters.
Yeah.
And I put big guys on the table and they just get destroyed. You know, I put a Beholder, you know, level 21 Beholder Death Tyrant, and it died in 3 rounds and never hurt anybody.
I've been having that problem even in the heroic tier, to be honest. My guy is just – we had a green dragon, and they're like, really? That's it? That's all the dragon was? So,
I'll tell you one thing, and they you know, I think it should just be a flat new solo rule that dazes and stuns don't do what they do to solos.
Yeah.
They do to normal creatures. I mean, if you're not – If somebody isn't house ruling that, they're going to find out that they're making a mistake.
That's part of the reason I don't really use holos anymore. Go into the monster builder and I'll change it to an elite and then build up the encounter from there.
Yeah,
because I find
that's a good approach.
It's a lot more interesting that way than just having one
throw a couple
one
out there.
Big enemy, having one slightly less tough enemy, and then having a lot of smaller enemies around it tends to make for a more entertaining fight, not just for the players but for me too.
Well, in Monster Manual 3, the dragons that are in the Monster Manual 3 are elites.
Yeah. You know,
they're elites that feel like solos, but they're not. So clearly Wizards has been thinking about that too. But I've always loved the big fight against the big monster, and I hated the idea that – and a lot of people said it like, well, they call it a solo, but it's not really a solo. You have to have more guys out there. And I always – that never sat right with me. You know, I'm like, wait a minute. It's called a solo. And, you know, Bilbo didn't fight Smaug and 15 other guys.
Yeah, you know,
fought one dragon and it mattered and it was really hard. So So the damage, I think, helps a lot with that. But I think there's still some, and a lot of the solos in Monster Manual 3 have helped. But I think that I still think that there are some basic house rules that have to go into play to make sure that solos don't get beaten.
Well, and yeah,
I think Game Fiend did wonderful stuff with his World Breakers and mm-hmm.
yeah.
those guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I love those. I use them all the time.
I understand the comment about stuns and basically just any kind of status effects against solos. And I hear a lot of conversation about how not fun it is when players get stunned or slowed or,
right.
you know.
Oh, wait. I'm writing a blog post about this right now. Like, I was halfway done when I had to start. Like, seriously, it's going to post tomorrow at 9 a.m.
So what are we spoiling it?
We'll definitely...
Let's talk about it.
The podcast will definitely go up after the blog post. So, but no, like, it's got to be a two-way street. I mean, and it doesn't have to be for every enemy, but solos definitely. If a solo is more comparable to a player and the amount of powers it has... Yeah, it should. Well, I'm just talking about, you know, a normal monster versus a player and then a solo versus a party. Solo should definitely feel those same bonuses that you give players. You know, if a player, if you don't use status effects like slow or stunned against players that often, you really should give your solo some kind of ability to get out of those things too. Otherwise, you'll end up with the, you know, I ran a solo against my party 2 weeks ago and, you know, 5-on-1. And they were slowing it and stunning it, and everybody was staying away from it. It just didn't feel like it had that much oomph to it until I brought it back from the dead with half hit points just on a whim, which...
Nice. You know, we tore ourselves.
They were all standing around it looting it, and I was like, hey, guys, guess what? He comes back. And that is actually a power in the monster builder. And so mm-hmm. I tagged it on, knowing that it was there, saying, yeah, this, yep. I'm like, this guy has that. So bam, there you go. And now you're back in combat. So
whenever my players start telling me what new powers they're picking out every level, whenever they start saying, oh, and I got this one is going to daze things, I'm like, okay, I know you really like it, so I'm not going to tell you not to, but oh.
Yeah.
Well, there's two. I mean, have you what house rules have you guys used to handle dazes and stuns, if any?
I have really no. haven't yet. I've limited the amount of monsters that I use that can even do it. That's the way I've looked at it so far. My players are low heroic at this point though, so they haven't had a lot of opportunity to get powers that stun and daze.
I don't think I really saw a problem until maybe high heroic, and then certainly in Paragon and Epic, you see it all the time.
Yeah, you see it around 8 to 12. That was the time when my party started showing it, you know, and I really don't like stun and dominate, and I make no bones about this, and this is what the blog post is about, because it's no fun for players to be taken out of the game. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if I take that out, then do I not allow them to use those powers? And if I allow them to use those powers in the interest of fun, because it's fun for them, then I'm going to have to tweak the monsters so that there's a way for them to sort of negate those powers part of the time. Or, you know, maybe they'll get an immediate save anytime a power is going to be applied to them. Yeah. And, you know, something like that that's simple, that I don't have to really keep track of very much, that's not going to complicate the sort of record keeping we already have to all do. But I don't actually know what the best solution is.
I've tried two that I like.
I would almost recommend, like, making your party fight a mirror of themselves, getting all their powers. And so if your party's taking a lot of dominate,
like, I got so much stuff.
Yeah, you got a party with a bunch of dominate and stun effects, and you're just like, okay, you're fighting some guys who look exactly like you, and so he dominates you. It's like, how fun is that?
And then,
I think that's the best idea, just because at that point it feels like you're punishing your players for the choices that they've made.
Right. Good. Yeah. Punish them.
There is actually my 2-3 or 4 sessions ago, I have a sorcerer, a conjurer, sorry, that one of my players picked, and we sort of just started a newer campaign. And he's got a conjuration that he casts, and that thing can dominate a creature. But the thing about that dominate is it's not a save ends dominate. It's a till the end of the next turn dominate.
Yeah.
So basically it dominates one creature for one turn, and that's it.
Right.
Which and, for me, that's not as bad. It's when something is a save ends and somebody's rolling bad that night.
The stun locks. It's where three of them get together in a row and they stun for four rounds.
Yeah.
Or even days for that matter.
Or days, yeah. But well, there's, and there's it... two. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. You go.
Well, there's two things I've tried, and I've been running variants of both of these two for a while that I've been pretty happy with. And one is that for solos, stuns and days still affect them, but it does different things to them. That a stun will remove the next standard action for a solo, and a daze will remove its next minor action. So that way, all of its immediates, all of its auras, all of its move actions, and if it use it can use action points, and if it gets multiple standard actions, it only loses one of those. And so that way, there's still an effect, and that effect is roughly mathematically close to affecting 1/5 of a solo. You know, if a solo is supposed to be five monsters.
Right.
You know, and you're stunning one creature. Well, that's about the equivalent if you're taking one of its six actions away or one of its five actions away. And that's been pretty reasonable. I haven't had a lot of, you know, people rebel at the table.
See, that's smart. That works. I like that.
And the nice thing is it doesn't hose them. You know, their stuns and dazes are still useful and they still feel like they got something accomplished. Mm-hmm. Well, at least he couldn't breathe on us this turn. You know, he still clawed us and he still hit us with his tail when we tried to get close, and he still has this aura around him. But, you know, and you also on both of those also continue to grant combat advantage. So, you know, your rogues are happy.
Now, I do need to say that, you know, as we're talking about this stuff, it really only seems applicable to solos, because when you're a DM controlling an encounter of six or seven creatures, having one guy stun locked or continually dominated doesn't cause you to lose control of the entire fight. Whereas
you probably want to do it. Sorry.
Oh, I was just saying, whereas if you have a player who's being consistently stunlocked, that keeps that one player out of that entire combat for multiple rounds.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there has to be that give and take of, okay, a standard encounter, let the players go crazy with their, you know, their stuns or their dazes or their dominates, and then solo encounters really have to be the ones that are focused on this exceptions to the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other time, though, is sometimes you're going to have an elite boss who is a main antagonist of the party, and you don't want him stunlocked. You know, like they've been chasing him for 10 levels, and now they've got him, and they just beat the pants off of him, and he never gets a chance to do anything. So I'd give
it to
him.
To the point where he can't even escape, let alone do anything.
Yeah, he can't do anything. So, I think pretty much every time I bring a named villain out, you know, some kind of, you know, major antagonist, you know, your Kalarel from Keep of the Shadowfell or Aranthem from, I don't know, whatever, Death's Reach. You know, those guys get some kind of defense from that stuff. They either get the you know, daze and stun, take their standards and moves. But a lot of times they have, like, immunities or they have prismatic shields that are protecting them, and they have something that... Mm-hmm.
I would even go so far as to create something like a special aura that, you know... If they have followers and the party decides to stun this main guy before they stun the rest of the followers, I would give him an aura that was like, you know, protect the fallen or all for the leader.
All get bonus damage. Yeah.
Exactly. So then the party pays for going after the main boss and kind of instead of having this encounter where you're like, wow, that was the main guy. That's all he had. We took him down in no time fast. It's just like, oh, crap, you know, we locked him out, and then that made all of his followers mad, and suddenly we paid for it. But I think I cut off Tracy, which I do a lot, so let's hear what she had to say.
Oh, I was just going to say, along those lines, though, with the anytime you have a leader, it can be difficult. So a lot of my encounters, particularly at lower level, in order to make the XP work, you have like a higher level leader and then you have lower level monsters. So if you take the leader out with stunning or dominate or whatever, you've pretty much locked down most of those other monsters aren't going to hit anyway either. So
my solution to that is instead of making the shield give them extra damage or something, you make this sort of prismatic shield or some sort of power that will deflect as long as the elite boss has his sort of minion people, his followers around him, and some of them are alive if they're within three squares or something, then he can deflect that stun or that daze onto one of them, and then they get it and he doesn't take the effects of that.
See, that's
exactly what I did for Aranthem.
Yeah.
That would also be really cool.
I have to say, as like a player advocate in this particular case, you don't really want to do that sort of thing all the time, because then again, you're going to make the players feel like they're being punished for their power choices. It sucks as a player to have stuff and never really be able to get to use it at the best time or the most opportune time, just because the DM doesn't particularly want. If you want to use it on a solo, occasionally you should be able to use it on the solo.
Yeah, well, that's why I think like named guys get it, but non-named guys don't. And even if you have a generic red dragon, you might be okay to stunlock him because it's fun to beat the hell out of a red dragon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you know, if you have your main boss, you don't want to do it for them.
Okay, I want to pause for just a second, and I want to say again? No, I don't have to. Thanks for checking though. Thanks for checking. I'm drinking water now. I'm hoping I'll feel better by the end of this whole situation. I did want to stop and see if Cato Cantonian is he still there? He's our guest listener tonight, so I just want to see if he had a mic on or anything.
I think he muted his for a while.
Okay. So he may not be listening. He might just be
No, he just told me he's still here.
Okay. I just wanted him to say hi. Say hi. You there, Cato? No? Okay, well then.
He says 1 second. Sorry.
I should say this right now also. Let me check this. With Lulu.com, order number 4381145 is a copy of the DM's Tip book written by a one Mike Shea.
Hey, I hear that's a great book.
Yeah, it's going to be delivered to my house in 5 to 10 days. So
really,
yeah,
you ponied up for the $4 shipping.
Oh hell yeah, man! I'm a dead tree kind of guy. I'm not big on the whole PDF thing right now. I'm just old.
I think Tracy was saying the same thing, and I'm like, I feel bad making people pay $4 for shipping.
Oh man, it's gonna be great on the way out to Gen Con when we're doing this awesome road trip. I'm gonna be reading it.
Exactly, exactly.
It's fun. I hope it's useful.
Mike, I
appreciate your support.
I bought your book. I'm not saying you have to buy one of my shirts now, but you know.
You know, I bought it and downloaded it, and I haven't read it yet, just for the same reason that everybody else is talking about. I'm really a dead tree type of person. I find it really kind of funny that all of us DMs are, or many of us DMs are.
You guys should have gotten together and bought a pack of them and get the free shipping and get.
Yeah.
We would have had to pay to ship them out to each other because none of us.
Yeah.
But I don't think it costs $4 a book. I'm pretty sure that's where Lulu gets their cut.
$4.
It's an 120 page book. I have a copy of it right here in front of me. It's the first copy that I pulled out of the box and the first one I checked and made a few tweaks to, but I'm pretty happy with it. I'm excited. It was fun.
I'm excited to get it and read it. I think it's going to be awesome.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I decided I'd buy it. Maybe, maybe it was a drunken impulse, but I bought it right now as we were
it works,
doing the
There's
podcast.
No such thing as drunken money.
Yeah. I drink and you win, so that's how it works.
You drink and everybody wins, Thaddeus.
There's a marketing campaign. Right.
Apparently. Yeah. So it's Cato's...
Sorry.
Oh, I just... Here. Okay. Say hi to the world, Cato Cantonian.
What's up, world?
Okay, now he's done. So what were you saying, Mike?
And I'm done.
I told him when he logged on, I gave him the paranoia computer voice. I said, Cato Cantonian, you have been selected to listen to the DM Roundtable podcast tonight. Do you accept this mission? And he said, yeah. So, there he is.
Yeah. So what were you saying, Mike?
I was just talking more about those damage charts, because I think it was a couple weeks ago, or I think it was the last time you guys got together and you were talking about all the errata and everything that was going on, and you were saying like, yeah, now I feel like my monster manual just sits on a shelf.
Yeah.
The book is basically worthless. And I'm like, I'm not going to make mine worthless. And I took a Sharpie and I went through and scratched all the damage out for almost every epic level monster.
I saw those pictures.
Yeah, and Sharpied in new damage.
You know what? I might do that, but I'll have
now
to go
I love my book again.
One. I'll have to go buy an extra one because I don't really want to write in it.
I was so, I did it at first because I wanted to have a good book, but then I just started keep doing it because people on Twitter were screaming at me.
Oh, we
like,
lost.
Oh my god, what are you doing?
We lost Randall.
We lost Randall. I'm trying to get him back, but looks like it's off.
But I'm still anyway. Here, so you know you got that.
Hello. Yes. Hey, you're supposed to be quiet now.
Yes, you were only selected to listen. Be quiet.
You know, I haven't cracked open one of my books for stats in I don't know how long. The only book I've cracked open at all of late has been the Chromatic Draconomicon, and that's for fluff more than anything.
Yeah.
Everything else, all the monsters, all the character powers, I just use the monster builder or the character builder.
Edit it.
Yeah.
Hey, Kato, can I ask you a question?
You sure can.
Yeah, do you like the Dead Tree version of books, or are you a PDF guy?
I like both.
Yeah?
I like to have the physical one where I can look through it, but then the PDF for what I'm like sitting.
Does that mean he's
going to
buy both?
That's two copies of your book right there.
Awesome.
I'm gonna print out a copy of this and then buy the Dead Tree.
Yeah, Kato, I have... Kato, I have just committed you to buying two copies of Mike's books. So.
Well, you know, he did write that book to help me run awesome Dungeons and Dragons.
That's games. Exactly right.
He wrote a story for both the Dungeon Master Guide and I've run a few games myself. So,
so
nice.
Speaking of books that come in both PDF and non-PDF formats, I have to say that last night I actually got a night off work. They, you know, I called them, said I didn't really feel like coming in. They called me back and said, hey, don't come in. And
you're fired?
Yeah, don't come in ever.
Don't come in ever again.
Well, I was just like, listen, guys, you guys got me working like, you know, 19 days straight without a day off. How about I just don't come in tonight because it's supposed to be slow? And so they said, okay, that's fine. And so I got my group together last minute, my regular Monday night D&D group, and we've decided that once a month we're going to play the Dresden Files. And we went through the city building, the world building system together, which is basically what the book spells out for you. And it was amazing. It was 4 hours of basically building a world with my players, where they were creating NPCs and they were creating quote-unquote hotspots. And at one point, one of my players looked up and was like, wow, you know, we could really do this in one of our D&D campaigns. And I don't know if any of you guys have read any of the Dresden Files stuff or not, but
yeah,
there is a crap ton of stuff in this game that could definitely be used for 4th edition that would really, I think, improve.
I love a lot of the concepts that they use for it, and I think importing some of them to D&D would definitely be good. Like the shared, not just the shared setting generation, but the shared character generation, like uh-huh. where you're writing something about your character, an adventure your character had, and then two other players have to write how they were a guest star in that particular story. I really love that idea.
Exactly.
If I'd had my books, my Dresden Files books, before I started my D&D campaign, I would have definitely stolen that outright.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The idea of, you know, looking at your character's story as a book, and here are either different books in the series or different chapters in the book. You know, what happened, who was in them, how are those people now connected with you? That is ingenious, because it really, I think I mentioned it in the last DM roundtable, but it really cuts back on that whole, you know, my character just walked off the boat. He's been adventuring around, but he knows nothing about anything. He doesn't really know the party he's with. He has amnesia. He has no family. It really forces them to have roots in the world that's been created around them. And
it's what I did when I rebooted my group. I mean, mm-hmm. I set them down and I paired them off, and I said, "Okay, I don't care how you guys know each other, but you've got to write it in to that you know each other, and I need to know how you know each other." And I deliberately paired them off that way, and it's worked out really well because they were, you know, things have come up. It's like, oh well, I remember when we used to do this, you know, before our adventuring careers started or whatever. And it's an excellent technique. So, I mean, larger groups, I mean, obviously, you know, you get three people, maybe that's not as useful, but
actually it is. I have a face-to-face group with only four people in it, And I do a sort of, whenever I start a new campaign, I do a sort of cooperative party building. The first session is, you know, everybody sort of introduces their characters to each other and they talk about it. And then I ask them a series of questions that forces them to think about what are the goals and how do they know each other and where are they from and what sort of history, you know, for example, if I ask someone what was the, you know, most spontaneous thing that their PC ever did at any time in their life before now, before their adventuring career, you know, and they answer something like, you know, oh, well, you know, I once, you know, stepped on the toes of an ogre and then tried to run away and he grabbed me. And then I'll go directly to the other person and say, you know, and you were there, what did you do about it? You know, and then that person gets to finish and it makes an interactive story where all the characters end up knowing and having some connection with at least one other character.
Yeah, you did that for our Monday night game, and it really did help us bring it together. Because I remember you asked me, I think I was the first one you asked a question to, and you asked me, what other character do you trust the most and why? And I really had to think about the other characters, what my relationships to them were, mm-hmm. who I really would trust, and what situation I would have to make me trust them. So it definitely helped bring the party together. I mean, maybe not as a meshed whole, but it definitely brought us closer together than, you know, you meet in a bar or mm-hmm. whatever.
Right.
So what tips do you guys have for the players that just freeze up at the table whenever you try to do something like this?
Let them freeze.
The thing that I do when someone freezes, I give them an option. I tell them, I give them two things. I say, I ask them if it's the question that they're having trouble with, like maybe it's just a question they don't really like, it's not interesting to them. And if so, I'll say, okay, I'll pass you and I'll come back with another question later. If it's just the whole they can't think on their feet thing, normally I just say, you know what, I'll let someone else answer for you. And when they answer for that person, I let the person who froze up then change that answer into something that's more compatible for them. Or I just tell them, you know, say the first thing that comes to your brain. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't have to be in the same time period. It can be anything, and we'll turn it into something that matches.
Yeah, and Tracy, that's exactly what I do, is that I will look – I mean, I usually know the players in my group. And so I will look to someone who I know is strong in writing story and say, you know, okay, so just like it's been said before, I'm just like, okay, so you were a part of this. So write yourself into that story and then make it make sense. And that person who's really strong in the role play sense and, you know, in the sense of writing story about his character will be able to write that and include this guy who, you know, has basically frozen. And usually that person knows – you know, not to make the person who's frozen look like the weaker person, but make him look like a very integral part of the story, which usually works really, really well. And then...
See, now, Thad, y'all are way too touchy-feely.
Randall, I gotta say, that's the first time in my life I've ever been called that.
Okay. Well... Let me explain. When I look at my...
I'll explain. He's from Topeka.
No, I lived in Kansas for a while. I know those guys, but...
No, when I look at my players, if I've got one, especially if we're in a role-playing situation, I've got one that freezes up, I remind them right then and there, it's like, we're having a conversation. That's all this is. And mm-hmm. it's like, give me something. You know, I'll either do it but with a look or I'll actually say the words... Give me something. Because something. We're having a conversation. You're standing. I mean, you're talking to this
good
NPC.
One.
Right, but you're talking to this NPC, and it's like, I expect you to respond with something. And so so it's sort of, maybe it's a little bit of a bully. Not a lot, because I'm not that really intimidating. But, you know, it's
well, you but you don't need to be. The situation itself is more than...
Yeah, I feel like...
Yeah, it's a pretty tough spot.
I feel like squeezing... a player who isn't that good at role-playing into role-playing just leaves me with the common, I have amnesia. My parents are dead. Everyone I know is dead, so I have no connection to the world. I mean, that's what
I've been lucky there, so I don't get those responses.
Yeah, usually when I... when I put pressure on people to come up with something, that's usually what they come up with, because they think of how, what's the easiest way for me not to ever have to do this again? Okay, I have amnesia. Yes. And now you'll never ask me about my past again because I don't know anything. And so I've really started to steer away from that, because I've had three groups now, and in three groups I've had like five players with amnesia, because they just don't want to come up with anything on their own. And so I would
I'll have to remember this one.
I would rather have
forevermore Tracy's characters are all going to have amnesia.
Well, I mean, Sam, you've been in a game where I played. I can freeze up like nothing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I would rather have someone else who really, really enjoys writing story on the spot just take over from there, because they get off on that stuff. You know, they're just like, oh boy, I got to come up with the new story. Okay, here we go. You know, I was adventuring and I found him and blah, 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 blah. And here it goes. Instead of the guy who's frozen, just spouting off the same thing I've heard four or five times before. And I've frozen.
But you always have to give that person the option to come back and change that story and make it theirs as well if they want to.
And I've never done that before, but I think now that I've heard it, you know, it's a good idea. I think
reason that doesn't work in my group is because they're all guys that have known each other for a long time. Well, and my wife as well, who's new to the group, but they know her as well. And they will do and say something that will immediately screw over the guy that's next to him, just to screw with him. So it's like, yeah, your dad was actually an ogre, and they will do that kind of thing. I just know them. That's how they act. But I want to address Tracy's comment about freezing up like that. And it's like, if someone asks you directly, because the next thing I say is, what do you do? Or what do you say, or whatever, to immediate response. So if you freeze up, how do you get out of that? I'm just curious. Because that, to me, is almost impossible to get out of. You're going to come up with some kind of answer.
Usually I don't. When I freeze up, it's terrible.
Okay.
So what I found is if it's really particularly bad, if we start off with roleplay, that's why I hate starting with roleplay. I always start with combat. because the thing is like when someone's coming at you with a club or a sword or something, you know what to do.
Right.
You're like, I don't want to end up as mincemeat. I'm gonna have to do something to stop this guy. Where if it's like you're in a tavern and apparently your insight or whatever can tell you that this person across the room is someone you should go up and talk to, that's just like, well, but what am I gonna talk about? What's the situation in town? What's everything look like? I have no idea. So I not only have to at that point come up with what my character is going to do, I have to try to fill in the story around it too, which just makes my brain freeze. Like
which is what we've kind of talked about before, where you as a player need to not be afraid of changing the world around you a little bit. Like you could walk up and say, how about this drought that we've been going through? You know.
Yeah, you could talk about the weather. I mean, I mean that works.
But you know, basically,
Tracy, are you the type of person that can mingle with a lot of people, like in a social situation in real life? Like, do you walk up to somebody, or if you're in the elevator with somebody, do you chat with them?
I often do.
That's what you have to do with your character.
Yeah. The world doesn't make sense to me, so it's harder.
Yeah.
See, I'm one of those people that can't make small talk like that, so it's difficult for me when I'm playing my character to kind of get over that. It's easier to some extent. It's about your group and your personality as a person, because I have a hard time, like I said, making small chat regardless, but the better I know people, the more I can't do it. If I go to like D&D encounters, I have a really hard time role playing. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. At my home game, I don't have as much of a problem.
I'd agree with that. I would be the same way, I think.
Yeah. So to some extent, when I'm running a game and people are reluctant to role play, that's what I try to figure out. Are they not role playing because they're not comfortable with it? Are they not comfortable with the group? Or do they genuinely not really know what they should do to role play? And if it's just a matter of comfort, then there's not a lot you can do about that except for let them adjust at their own pace. If it's a matter of they don't know what to do, then you can start to kind of help them along better. I mean, you can do like Thaddeus said, where you can go, okay, he's going to write a story, and this is going to be the background. Work with him on it, interject yourself to it, and make sure it's as much your story as it is his, and go from there.
Well, in the case of like what Tracy's example of, you're in a bar and your insight tells you that this guy over here is paying attention to you and seems to want to speak to you. You know, in that position, if you don't really know anything about the world and this is the first time you've been in it and all that, I would just ask questions. I would just ask the DM, you know, what's the weather like outside? What's the atmosphere inside the tavern? Are there a lot of people there? Is there, you know, a jester or a bard up in the corner performing something? Is it deserted? Is it poor? Is it rich? Is it, you know, what does the guy look like? Is he wearing, you know, heavy armor, or is he in fine clothing, or is he in tattered, you know, cloth?
I also think that as a DM, you need to be more proactive in situations like that, because I think the problem in this particular situation that we're talking about is that there is no expectation. What is the player expected to be doing? He's obviously expected to go over and talk to the person, but why can't you have the person go and talk to them and initiate conversation and avoid the whole problem in the first place?
You're right. Mm-hmm. The onus is on the DM to make sure that that encounter occurs. I mean, or to a point. I mean, you don't want to force it. You don't want to railroad. But you have to – if you can see a player freezing up – and I know we've kind of put Tracy on the spot tonight, but
– No, it's fine.
Yeah, you know, Tracy.
Hey, but, I'm advocating for new players.
That's right. And but if you see them freezing up, it's up to the DM to coax them along. And
Tracy, do you like role-playing?
I do when I'm the DM. I hate it when I'm the player.
So, I mean, the other side of it is, as a DM, you kind of have to recognize what individual players like. And if you see somebody who could be kind of interested in role-playing but isn't really sure how to start, that's different from somebody who doesn't like it. If somebody doesn't like it, you know, find someone else to talk to.
Well, that's the problem. Well, they keep talking to me, and I'm like, I don't know what to tell you.
You know, the other side of that coin is if the player doesn't like to role play, but they roll up a bard with high diplomacy and high streetwise, I'm sorry, they're playing the wrong character, and you need to speak to them about maybe they need to play a different type of character.
Well, to some extent, that's true, but I also think you need to take into consideration that the role playing shouldn't be the be-all, end-all of what your character can do. The dice and the stats and the character sheet, they have a lot to do with it, too. Yeah. And I think there are times where you would like the character to role play. But you also have to acknowledge that sometimes people just want to go, okay, I could role play this out, but let me just roll streetwise and find what I'm looking for, or try to find what I'm looking for, and go on.
Well,
I mean, sometimes what I do to encourage role playing in situations like that is to give them a bonus to do it. But otherwise, I'll let them go, okay, if you role play it out, I'll give you like a +2 on the roll. But otherwise, you can just roll it and do whatever you want.
Well, I agree with that. But sometimes in the game, you're going to have to, you know, just like sometimes there's going to be a fight with a solo and you have to mess with it. You know, sometimes if you're the player with the highest diplomacy, you're going to have to role play that. Even if 90% of the time the DM lets you roll it, you know,
The thing is, I think sometimes DMs don't give enough information. They think they're giving a ton, but they're not. For instance, I was in that game with you, Samuel, and we were talking.
I wasn't running it.
But it was the negotiation. It was great, but I froze up then with the negotiation over how much pay we would get, because I had no idea what a reasonable sum would be.
Mm-hmm. Like buying a car, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know, I could say 100 gold pieces, I could say 5, they're all the same to me right now.
I think she started with a really low amount, and after we had all said, oh yeah, Tracy will negotiate, and then she threw out a little amount, and then we were all like, wait,
that was the worst negotiation ever.
Well, it was a bad negotiation, and I felt so terrible. I just like froze up for the rest of the game.
Has drove me to go back to kind of the DMing 101 basics, which is you know, for both combat encounters and just room description, and for social encounters, I've gone back to using a very basic sheet where I fill out very mundane information about what the room looks like, what the people you're interacting look like, you know, what the setting is, what can and can't be used in combat, what your players might notice with a certain DC check. There are basic things I write about almost every encounter now that half the time get overlooked and it feels like superfluous information, but that kind of information I found comes in really handy to the players. And, you know, that's it's a very basic sheet that I wrote up on Word. I'm terrible at design, but, you know, it has the basic information of what can you get out of certain DC checks? What is in this room?
You know, it's one of the problems with – it's actually one of the things that I have a complaint about 4th edition, which is amazing, is that – and I love dungeon tiles. I have at least two of every set. But one thing that it did to me that I noticed after about a year that I've been trying to work on, and it's a constant battle to work on this, is that I got used to laying down the dungeon tiles and setting it out and saying, okay, it's pretty much what it looks like. So if I put a bookcase, you know, a little tile with a bookcase on it, there's a bookcase there.
Exactly.
Instead of telling the players, look, here is actually what it is. And it's actually one of the things that playing online has helped me with, because even though there's a map there, I tend to want to voice the description so that they get a more full idea of what's going on.
Do you guys write your own read aloud text?
Yeah.
No.
I do sometimes. It depends on what the situation is.
That's my way to kind of make sure that I don't fall into the trap of saying, like, okay, the room is 10 squares wide, and this is difficult terrain, and if you step in here, you'll get set on fire. If I spend the time to write my own read-aloud text early, then I don't have to ad-lib at the time. I've got it prepared, and I can read it dramatically and make fun of my own typos. And everyone.
Well, that's what
I kind of like, the ad-libbing, because then I can add details or take away details, because not every time the players go into a room or a series of rooms, they're not always going to want to know all the details about it. And there are other times where they might want to know a lot more details than what you've written down. Right. So I find that I'll get an idea of what things look like, and then I'll ad-lib it on the fly, because I think that, to me, is a lot more creative, because it'll sound like, okay, if they're interested in this part of the room, I can describe that room a lot better. If they're not,
the other thing I do is... If you don't show the map until after you've described the room, it can also help you. It helps them try to imagine what the room looks like, and it helps you, you know, focus on the important aspects of the room without having a map already out there. I mean,
well, and that's,
I keep my dwarven forces all covered up.
Dungeon tiles really kind of hurts in that respect. I love dungeon tiles, but they do kind of, they take a while to set up. So while I'm setting up, the players are probably looking at it and getting an idea of what the room may or may not look like before I even describe what it is.
Do you ever pre-build your rooms?
I don't pre-build them. I'll get the room together and I'll have all the tiles that I'm using for it, but I have to build it when I get there.
I was encouraged to start building out my encounter areas ahead of time.
Yeah.
if you want to speed up the game,
that's a quick way to do it.
You know why I don't, though? Because I don't always know which direction my players are going to go on any given night.
That's the problem I've run into.
Usually there's about three different options, and so I'm like Aaron. I have them set up in little bags, and then if they go that way and they run into that encounter, I can set it out, and I don't have to go looking for a piece. But
that's where my DM 101 sheets have really helped me, is that I've written out descriptions of all the rooms, and I can add or subtract whatever I want, but I have the
base.
Yeah, I usually fill out the information that the players have on average always wanted to know about the room. How much lighting is there? Is there anything I can hide behind? Does anything look breakable? Does anything look burnable? Can I push anything over?
And all of these questions, as usual
as that stuff is.
But that's the thing. You say my players ask more questions than yours do. You know the questions that your players ask on average. And so you can create your own little room guides with the questions that your players normally ask. And you'll always have that information for them. Every once in a while, my players will ask a question out of the blue that I've never heard them ask before. And I'm like, I don't have that on my sheet. So I have to make it up. But the reality is I have their average questions covered because I know they ask those every week.
Well, the trap that I fall into is that they will ask me things. I will say something. I'll give them all this great text or whatever, and then they'll question me about what it is. Like, for example, I made a note of the time, and we're in the middle of Thunderspire Labyrinth, right, which is underground. And so one of the things that immediately, as soon as I said, well, it's late afternoon, and then they looked at each other and me, and I both realized, how the hell do we know that? How do we know it's late afternoon? And so I had to come up with this fact. Well, the candles underground here are made of a tallow wax that burns at a specific rate. It's a little
well,
metal.
Welcome.
There's a metal slide that's, hardcore. I mean, a metal ruler that sits next to the thing, and that's how you count off the hours. The candles are changed on a regular basis, and so that's how you know what time it is underground here in this particular
Well, yeah, place. Welcome. Welcome to being a DM. I mean, it's all about they're going to ask you questions you were so not expecting, and you're going to have to think on the fly.
And, well, but you know, go ahead, Tracy.
We've that happened to me this week. I use Hammerfast for Andernach in my town, and I had said something silly like the guy in the cave likes to have the kids bring him his meals every day from the finest inn in town. And suddenly they're like, well, we had to go to the finest inn in town and find out what he eats. And I was like, crap. Okay. Well, flip through the book, find the finest inn. And then they're like, okay, well, what food do they have? And I'm like, well, they have the finest foods. They fly in on hippogriffs every day, fresh from the...
Wow.
And we just went off on it. And it's great.
Man.
So see that. So I like to improvise and be spontaneous, but I do have this little document that has menus for like fantasy games. Tracy, I can send you a copy if you want.
Oh, those are so boring. Hippogriffs are much better.
But one thing that happened to me, and Aaron has to like close his ears right now, is that I was running the online game that I run on Monday nights, and there was this point where one of the players had to climb up a chimney and pull a stone out and look inside. And I said that the brick had this code of letters on it, or they found something and it had this code of letters and numbers on it. And I told them what it was. And so now we've spent like three sessions, them trying to figure out what this code and letters is. And when it first happened, there wasn't really much of a mystery to it, but because they didn't get the sort of thing that was obvious to me, which this is a common problem, right? Something's obvious to the DM that's not obvious to the players, but it was obvious to me and they didn't get it. So they kept looking around. And so now it's become this giant thing. And so now it's sort of morphed, even in my notes and everything, into something that is really meaningful for them. And so they're still trying to figure out what it is, but now when they figure it out, it will be very meaningful, right? So I sort of did that spontaneously because, hey, you know what? When the players pick up something and they think it's interesting, my job is to make it fun and interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I love red herrings. I will let them go on and on and on about the most mundane things because it's hilarious for me to watch. I mean, that's my fun as the DM. It's like, yeah, you keep talking about that glass that you just found or whatever, like it's a big deal. It's
See,
a glass.
And I've done that before.
That.
Oh, go.
I changed a room in – I'm running Rescue at Rivendell, and I changed one of the rooms to have a magical mural that so it was kind of like a picture window out over the surrounding landscape.
Right.
And the players really poked around that, and they were like, okay, there has to be something important about this because why else would they have a magical mural like that? So they poked around with it.
Yeah, players say that to me all the time, yeah.
Yeah.
And until they're like, okay, if there's something interesting about it, we can come back to it later after we've killed all the goblins. but they definitely picked up on that. I didn't really intend for them to really focus on it like they did, but they definitely were more interested in it than I thought they would be.
Yeah, well, my player's first question is, can we sell it?
Good. Very mercenary of your players.
They're very mercenary. If they can't use it as a magic item or sell it, they are often... they immediately become disenchanted. So,
see, I ran an adventure once that had a trap, or basically like a room feature that had these colored tiles, right? And so they were all primary colors. And then if you stepped on two, like red and blue, and it made green, if you made green, it made a certain effect happen. Like you swapped character sheets with the enemy, and you played the enemy for a round, and they played your character. It was almost like a cross domination. Or, you know, if you made purple, something else happened. And it freaked them out. They were just, and so every time they see any kind of a glyph or a carving, they freak out.
Yeah. And my group does that with pillars. Whenever so like, they see a pillar, they're convinced it's going to kill them.
Yeah. So four or five encounters later, they enter a room that has a carving on the floor, and it was just a mundane carving that was on the dungeon tile. So I'm like, yeah, that carving's there. Why not? They spent like 30 minutes trying to figure out what the carving does. And I was just like, okay, you rolled an arcana check. It doesn't do anything. You rolled a history check. It's just a...
You know what's fun to do with that is especially with like thievery checks, it's like you don't find anything unusual.
Right.
And then let them process that and go, yeah. Wait, does that mean I didn't find it? Or
I didn't roll high enough. There? Yeah.
You guys don't have one guy in your group that's the guy who loves to jump up and down on everything that looks like it could be dangerous?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I got one of those. Yeah.
I pull every book off of that shelf.
And then I kill them.
My entire group loves their characters to death. Like, they have so much story and involvement with their characters that when they come across something that they think could potentially kill one of them, they poke it with sticks from like 20 feet away. Because they
nuke it from space.
Was the best thing ever.
Yeah, exactly. They bust out the 10-foot pole and they poke it because they do not want to get anywhere near it. So I just get – I have so much enjoyment of watching my players dance around a rune, like a one-square rune on the floor that does nothing for like 20 minutes. And I tweeted about it once and people were scolding me. Talking about, you know, how bad that is, but I don't care. I was having a great laugh. And they were engaged.
You know what else is really good for that is statues or suits of armor.
Yeah.
Just put them up. Especially if you have the statue or armor miniatures, just go ahead and put them up in the room, leave them to decoration and watch the players treat them like, you know, the worst possible thing ever. It's great.
You can actually use it to herd your players. You know, if you have a particular area you want them to go, you can, you know, put lots of statues and suits of armor up on the other side, and they won't go near him.
You could go in that room, but it's full of statues.
No,
we're good. We'll go this way.
Yeah.
Hey guys, yeah. I need to take off, but this has been great.
Awesome.
Mike,
well,
great. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for stopping by.
I can do so again.
Well, this may just be a good time to call it and say goodnight to everybody because we've been going.
I don't need to end everyone's fun.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
What's that? I don't know. Not yet, man. There's some
other things. listen to this. No, don't stop yet.
Stop. I don't turn into a pumpkin until 11:30, so.
Yeah. We talked about doing this like on a bi-monthly or just every once in a while basis, but so far we've been doing it on a weekly basis. So, you know, Mike, expect to be invited back at some point again.
I'd love to have fun
with us.
Yeah, it's a great time.
Once Newbie DM gets back and the FOT game starts going, it probably won't be on Tuesdays. I think I referred to it as a semi-irregular podcast.
Well, I think the Fellowship of the Tweets game has become a every other week thing because Newbie started up a fourth edition game that he wants to run also. So we'll definitely at least do this twice a month.
Well, I'd love to be back.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Talk to you guys later.
All right.
See you later, Mike.
All right.
See you later.
Bye.
Night, Mike.
So
now that he's gone, let's talk about him behind his back.
Because
he'll never listen.
It was great having him on.
Yeah, he'll never listen to the podcast, so we'll just rip on him. No, he's an awesome guy. I'm excited because I honestly did order his book while we were podcasting here. So I'm stoked. Is Cato Catonian still there? Now that we're kind of on a slight little pause,
I am still here.
Okay, you're great. You're done again. Okay, so going back into,
I'll be here all night.
Cato, you really got to get your mic fixed so we can actually have you on instead of just as our guest listener every week.
Then I lose my special status.
Yeah. Okay, so let's. Honestly, I want to talk about a little something that happened while Tracy and Randall and I were not on the podcast. And,
okay,
you know, Aaron basically called me a whiny little bitch, and the And you guys talked about how you didn't want to talk about the new Essentials line and whatnot because you were just adding to the noise.
No, that's not true.
No, I do believe you. The exact comment was, we don't want to add to it because we feel like we'd just be adding to the noise. And
that was more of the talking about the errata.
Okay.
The Essentials.
I
don't think we got into the Essentials at all, actually.
Well, that's why you didn't get into the Essentials. Believe me, I listened to that podcast twice. I know exactly.
Listen, he has some anger he has to deal with, and we should just let him deal with it, and then we can all be friends again.
Thaddeus?
You know what? You know what? The fact that you listened to that twice just made my ego grow.
you talked about me a little in it. Of course I'm going to listen to it a few times. I have a sizable ego myself. I'm not going to not deny
didn't
that.
Didn't we blame you for something entirely in that one?
Apparently for the last week you guys have been blaming me for everything. But
yes. Yeah, I know I blamed you for all our technical troubles last night.
I'll overlook
the reason
that.
My mic doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kato. Thanks.
Thank you, Kato.
But honestly...
If y'all put your E-peens away, then, you know.
Yeah, I know.
My E-peen is huge. No, so as we're talking about it, because I just brought it up, the Essential line, honestly, yes. After, like, 2 days after we recorded our podcast and released it with so much commentary on, you know, what we fear and what we're excited about for the Essentials line, they release another little kind of like press release about it. And drop even more, just really it's ambiguous, just an entire post once again by Wizards that is so ambiguous about it, but again, full of basically design speak, you know? And the whole post that they wrote was all about compatibility. And they also mentioned at one point, and I was talking with Newbie DM online about this, name dropping again, here we go, Newbie DM. I was talking with him and a couple other people about this, that they really went off about how compatible Essentials was going to be with the rest of D&D, but at the same time, it was going to be a new starting point, which if you heard that kind of talk from Microsoft or Apple, the first thing you would think is new operating system. Anytime compatibility is an issue, you're talking about a new system. Because no one has ever talked about compatibility with Martial Power 2. I never saw a single word about, hey, we're releasing Martial Power 2 and it's completely compatible with all the other 4th edition rules that we've released. Hey, we're releasing the Player's Handbook and it's completely...
But in fairness to WotC, one of the reasons that they're saying that is because this isn't just another splat book they're releasing. It's a new repackaging of a way to get... new players into the game. So it's a repackaging of the rules. But basically what they're saying is the rules are basically the same. All the errata up to now will be included in the Essentials line, and we're giving sort of simplized characters. This is what they're saying, though. I don't know anything, you know, but from what I gathered from it and the way that I'm choosing to interpret it, which is different, obviously, from the way you're choosing to interpret it, is that they're trying to simplify it down so that any person who's never played a role-playing game at all and never played D&D and doesn't know anything about it can pick this up and play, and it's simplified. But it's still compatible so that if that person wants to take that same character and join a group that's been already going on for the past 2 years, they can do so with that very same character because it's completely compatible.
Right.
It strikes me as the divide with basic and advanced back in the day. Basic, I mean, it was essentially the mm-hmm. same rule set, but it was considerably simplified. But you could also take that character and with some changes, use it in any AD&D game.
Well, and from what my understanding is, it's not even that much of a divide as what you're talking about, Aaron.
Right. Yeah. I don't think that it's the same as the basic.
It's reminiscent of that. But my point is that I think that the key words that I saw in all of those posts and all those announcements is that this is like another build.
Yeah. Right.
And to me, it's another build. Sure, they've come you've approached the build a little differently, but if it's just another build, then I'm cool. It didn't freak me out all that much with this. It's not a, I haven't read the rules, but you know, I just.
I guess for me, it's not about being freaked out. It's about the fact that I feel like they're not owning up to exactly what it is. Like I'm still excited about it. I'm still going to play it. It's still D&D, no matter what it looks like. But to me, it's like saying, it's like being back in high school saying, you know, oh, I don't like that girl, but you really do. Like, what's the point of saying it's not something when it kind of is? When you look at the new release that they did, that they posted on Twitter, that said D&D Essentials is the new starting point moving forward with D&D. Anyone who starts in D&D, that's where they want you to start, is Essentials. So originally, 2 years ago, you had the core set, the Player's Handbook, the DMG, the Monster Manual. That was where you started when you played D&D.
But now, didn't they also have a starter set for 4th Ed?
Yeah, they did.
But
yeah,
it was,
I think what might be happening is we're all overthinking it, and they're basically phasing out that sort of starter set and giving a new one that's more robust, it sounds like.
I would agree with,
like, it's more of a basic rule set as opposed to the previous one, which I think was, I think it was basically just keep on the Shadowfell, more or less.
Yeah, I just can't agree with that, because the starter set was so maligned and it was so not well done that I don't ever think that was intended to be where people started. I mean, it was called the starter set.
I think it was maligned because it sucked, and I think that they've learned that, so they discontinued it, and now they're doing something different. And this whole argument, I think, goes back to what I was saying about how the whole first release of 4th edition has all been mostly DM-focused. And what they've realized is if they want new players that have never played D&D before and never played a role-playing game before or very little experience, they need to get something that's better than the Player's Handbook. Because let me ask you this, Tracy, because I know Tracy's probably the newest player who has played and DM'd.
Yeah, when Tracy, first, let's all...
Tracy, no. When, Tracy, when you first read the Player's Handbook, did you know what the hell was going on?
No.
Right. So the Essentials line, I think, is meant to be the entree for people that have never played before, that they can read from a player's perspective and say, okay, I totally understand what's going on now. Because you couldn't do that with the Player's Handbook. But that doesn't make it, for me, a new edition.
But
so here's...
I think there are two things we're missing from this discussion. First of all is the big controversy that happened with 3 to 3.5. And they're trying to fight that ghost still, I think, with the release. That's why they're saying it's
definitely
compatible. Because my understanding, because I didn't play back then, was that some people, like, they would say that 3.5 was going to be compatible with 3, and it just wasn't. And I don't think they're going that route with this new with the Essentials line. I think the other thing we're forgetting to talk about is that 4th edition wasn't finished when Player's Handbook 1 and the DMG 1 came out. They've been evolving it and changing it and making it better as time went on. And so that's why at the time it was very hard to come out with something that was for brand new players, because the rules weren't done yet, like completely. Like, they hadn't had the complete vision yet of what it was that 4th edition was going to become. And they finally feel that they're at that point where they can come up with a rules compendium and this introduce you to the game.
And go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, I was just saying that I think the reason why the players haven't been as much of a focus is because they knew that they weren't going to get brand new players into 4th edition in quite the same numbers when 4th edition first came out. They had to convince people who already loved to play D&D to play this new edition to fuel the book sales.
So the third thing that we're forgetting, those are two very good points. The third thing that we're forgetting is that none of us work for WotC and none of us have any insider information. Yeah. We're all talking out our asses and we're conjecturing, which is why I think the whole comment was made last time that we didn't want to talk about it, because we're just adding to the noise, and the noise all mostly consists of people who really don't know what's going on.
But I do
understand that it's worrsome, you know.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is,
because speculation is totally unwarranted. I think that it's okay to question those kinds of activities. Now, keep in mind, guys, anyone that remembers second edition, right before third edition came out, a few years before, they released Player's Option for second edition, which is basically what this kind of is. I was looking back at that, and it's like, you know, it's compatible, but it's really, you know, it's like you've said, Sam, it's a new way to start. It's an optional start. Doesn't mean you can't crack open a first, you know.
That's the difference, though. Right now, WotC is saying Essentials is the place to start from here on out once it's released. Like, it is new starting. And hold on.
Marketing speak.
Right. Well, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with releasing an updated version. There's nothing wrong with learning with Wizards of the Coast learning from the 3.0 to 3.5 split. It was terrible for them. You know, they had a very hard time with it because they basically changed the game.
Screwed it up.
Mid-version.
They didn't do it right. So see, what they're doing is they're trying to not do that again.
So they've learned from that, which is all the changes to 4th edition have been public and open, and they've been slow and methodical. Every couple months, we get new errata. The game changes. We get a couple months of getting used to the new changes, and then more changes come out. And eventually, they release all that in a book format saying, but the reality is, if you look at the new Rules Compendium and the new Essentials line, and you look at the original Player's Handbook, you have two completely different rule sets. Is the new Essentials 100% compatible with the original Player's Handbook? No, it's not, because the rules have changed so much since then.
Why not? Can you give me an example? Because that's the part where, until I actually see the rules, I'm going to question you on that, because I don't
stealth,
I believe what...
Stealth, dominate, movement rules, a lot of powers have been updated. Half the powers in the book have been changed. The keywords, the
right, but
function.
Wait, but wait.
So this is all I'm saying. Hold on, let me finish my thought. The reality is there's nothing wrong with a version upgrade. There's nothing wrong with a version 4.25 or a version 5, especially if you do it in this slow way and you do it in a way that it's completely compatible with what you've already been playing. I think they're afraid of calling it a version change because of what happened with the 3.0 to 3.5. And that's the only thing that I guess riles me up a little bit, is that they're not willing to call it what maybe it already is a version upgrade. I think it can be fine as long as you do it the right way. They've learned their lesson. They've learned how to do it in a way that is acceptable to the gamers and that doesn't shake things up too much, you know, in a very slow and very planned out process. And I think it's a great way to do it. I think I would rather have that than the kind of Microsoft version of an upgrade, which is all of a sudden one year you have to spend a bunch of money and completely upgrade everything that you've already bought, because nothing works with the new version anymore. But just being afraid to use the terminology, or just being afraid to call a horse because you think people are going to get mad, that's what upsets me. I'm fine with changing the rules. I'm fine with coming out with a new rules compendium that has different rules than the original books had. I'm fine with an Essentials lineup that has new builds and has new mechanics for the way they think classes should really work, especially since they all work with the existing game that we're playing. I'm just not fine with this marketing setup that is trying to hide what it really is because they're afraid of a backlash. I guess that's what gets me. Not any of the changes.
Well,
Sam, go ahead. What were you going to...
I don't know. Here's the thing. This is marketing. This is marketing speak, okay? What they're doing is they're trying to, you know, I think Tracy's right. They knew that they couldn't get new players with the rules the way they were when they first released it, because the format was for, and it was targeted to, people who already understood mostly what a role-playing game was and what Dungeons & Dragons was supposed to offer. And then they did it in a very slick, colorful way that would bring in players who maybe have left the Dungeons & Dragons fold and who now maybe moved on to computer games and very colorful different games. And now they're coming back because of all these new ways to present this game that they remember from long ago or something. Putting in really new players with that, because it was too technically difficult to do so. And so they didn't even try. now it's been 2 or 3 years. They've upgraded everything. There's been, you know, a lot of people and a lot of, you know, wonderfully talented people working on it. And they keep giving us these updates because they think it's making the game better. And that's their whole intent, is to improve the game and sell more products. And now they're going to release something that is specifically targeted to new people. Let's grow the hobby. And the way to do that is to say, it's new. It's a new starting place. Let me give you an example. When I wanted to get back into D&D, I looked around, and at the time, 3.5 was the current edition. And I looked at everything that was out there, and not even counting like the OGL third-party stuff. You know, I looked at what was out there that had been produced for this game, and I was like, there is no way that I'm going to be able to get a game going and run a game, because there's so much out there already that I don't understand and I don't know about it, because I never played 3rd or 3.5, and I'm not even going to try. And there was no real good starter set for 3.5 either. It sucked too. Now, they realize that. And now it's been 3 years since the release of 4th edition, and they're saying, okay, now the people that are going to play it, that are going to convert, and the old people that already have, you know, started to play 4th edition, we don't need to hook them in anymore. They're already playing. So what we're going to do, we're going to start this encounters program to get new people in, to sort of show them how it works in combat and how the sort of dynamics of the game work. And then we're going to hit them with this new essentials line that's the new starting point. You buy this and you don't have to worry about any of that other stuff that's been published, because this is all inclusive, and it's going to contain 10 products that if you buy those 10 products, you will be current, and it'll be the most current rule set, and you'll never have to buy another book again, and you don't have to worry about spending hundreds of dollars buying the other books that have already been published. Okay,
I think that's a really good way of looking at it, Sam, because to move away from like a role-playing game standpoint, I mean, however, have you ever gotten into a TV series that's like 6 or 7 seasons long? Haven't you ever wanted to be able to just be able to start watching and be able to catch up and not feel like you're behind on everything? I think that to some extent that's what this is. It's almost a reboot, so new players can come in and not feel overwhelmed by the sheer number of source books and DM books and other options that are available for that have been coming out for the last couple of years. Yeah. I think that's I've never had it happen with a role-playing game, but if you apply it to like video games or DVDs or whatever, you can definitely see how they would want to have a new point where people can just jump on without having to start all the way back with products that were released 2 years ago.
The other thing is, if you look at each of the monster manuals and each of the player's handbooks, you can think of them as point releases in the evolution of 4th edition. Monster Manual 2, they definitely also made changes to how they were creating and presenting monsters, and the same with Monster Manual 3, and the same with the player's handbooks all the way through, and PHB 3 was particularly different with the reintroduction of PowerPoints and systems like that. The other thing I'll say is that they need something that you point new players to, because I've been looking through the PHB 1 again, and nowhere in there does it explain like how you actually write in your ability scores or anything like that on your players on your character sheet. And they need something that walks somebody through the process of creating their character to really bring new people in who don't have existing players around them to support them.
And also, this is aimed at people who maybe have no intention of getting a DDI subscription.
Right.
You know, or maybe people that have heard, oh yeah, get DDI for 1 month and get the character builder and then drop your subscription or whatever. Because you can do that, but then you've only got the most current from whatever, whenever you downloaded it or whatever. But, you know, that's sort of like, it's almost like gaming the system, right? They don't really want people to do that. They want people to subscribe to DDI because they want all the content and they want everything. But if you're a new player and you don't have access to DDI yet, what's going to make you spend money for that subscription if you can't even look at the player's handbook and make any sense of it? You're not going to do that. I wouldn't. If I saw a product and I wanted to get into a game and I didn't really know that much about it, but I had heard it's kind of cool, but it's this sort of new mysterious thing, I'm not going to go pay $15 for a subscription to some online thing when it's not really all that much less complicated than the PHB either. If you really don't know what you're doing and you go into the character builder and you're not that computer savvy, it's not really intuitive. you don't really know what you're doing. So they need something that's going to point really new players to here's where you look, that's going to show you, just like the old basic rule book, the OD&D rule book that you go through, and it actually says, step one, you know, rolling your ability scores. Here's how to do that. Here's what all these ability scores mean. And now let's put them on your character sheet. And now what bonuses and pick your class. Here are the classes and races. And it goes through very step by step, whereas the player's handbook seems like it does that to an old school player who's played for a long time or who has lots of experience, but it really doesn't for new players. It doesn't. Tracy's right. There is nowhere where it really says. You know, the best they do is that little two-page thing at the end of the classes chapter, yeah. Or the end of the whatever that chapter is, chapter two, that has right. The layout, and it's got dots with numbers in it to show you what you're supposed to find where. But it doesn't really tell you, oh, go to page 32, and it'll tell you all about hit points.
Right. Yeah,
or go to page 83, and it'll tell you all about fortitude. There is nothing like that.
I also think this is kind of their next stepping point from D&D Encounters. I think they're intending to get people interested in D&D with D&D Encounters because they don't have to pony up anything for it. And then they're intending that if you are interested but you don't know if you want to invest in the core rule books, you can get this, the D&D Essentials, and basically have enough to play. And because it's supposed to have solo adventures, right?
I don't know. I think I heard something about that.
I heard something about solo adventures, and if that's the case, it really is just a stepping stone from playing a pre-gen character in D&D Encounters to making your own character, probably a relatively simplified character. They probably don't have the sheer number of options that you do even in the original player's handbook.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Tracy.
I was just going to say real quick that I found one of my early attempts at a character sheet over the weekend. And you know how you get racial modifiers to some of the ability scores?
Mm-hmm.
I had put them in the ability mod column. Because I had no idea.
Noob.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding.
Total noob. I should just scan it in and put it on my site and people can laugh at me.
But you know what? Just to build on what Aaron was saying, I think that, like I said, the encounters pull people in. And then Wizards wants to give you two choices. You can invest in our hobby and you can get all the core books and you can get all these extra splat books and blah, blah, blah. Or you can invest in the game, which is a kit mm-hmm. now, and you have all of this stuff self-contained. The two are – sure, there's some minor differences, but there aren't any major structural differences. And so essentially you have a compatibility that's okay. But again, it separates the hobby or the hobbyist – from just the gamer or the casual gamer or the player who's not mm-hmm. going to probably DM but still wants a good, you know, feels like he's got a good selection of the rules at his disposal. So I think that's where it divides it. So
I guess
the question Thaddeus is asking, though, is does it then qualify as a new edition? Because he's right. If Windows released something and all they talked about was compatibility, you would immediately think, oh, that is because it's a new thing and not that it's an extension of a current thing.
Right. And my point is kind of falling through the cracks in that I'm not worried about, you know, how is this going to affect me as a gamer? Will I have to learn a bunch of new stuff?
Not falling through the cracks. Well, is that you're not upset, but WotC is afraid that the majority of their players will be
right.
because of what happened between 3 and 3.5. So they're not going to come out and say, oh, yeah, and by the way, this is 4.5. Okay? Well, they will not do that.
You know, I'm not even in the camp that it's 4.5. I'm really looking at it as more of like a 4.25 because it's been such a slow roll. You know, we've been playing with a lot of the rules and a lot of the updates, you know, for months at a time. And yeah, some stuff is going to hit us as brand new with the Essentials lineup, but a lot of it's stuff we've been playing with. I wish we could all be in the know and that the whole group could be so adult as to say, listen, we've updated everything. You know, it's definitely a different version than the original version that we listed. Because, you know, DM Samuel, you yourself, when you were going off about all of the updates. You said that it was upgraded, that they over time have upgraded everything.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Look,
when you upgrade,
if they didn't listen to people and they weren't making changes based on customer feedback, everybody would say, "Oh, WotC doesn't listen to us. They're not upgrading. They're not making errata. They're not making changes." Okay, if they did do that, and they do, everybody complains, "Oh, they make too many errata. Oh, there's too many updates. Oh, there's too many changes." You know, they can't win. So what they're doing is they're trying to pad their marketing and reduce the amount of stuff that gets out such that it's even keel.
Well, on top of it, what if they had just released it as a PHP 4 instead of calling it Essentials? It would be the same thing. It wouldn't necessarily the basic core of 4th edition, I mean, I know you pointed to Stealth and a lot of other things that have changed over time, but a lot of the basic core of 4th edition is still the same. Players have powers. They have a variety of powers that they can choose at each time, depending on what the situation is.
No major structural differences.
Yeah.
And they can't call it PHP 4 because, and I know that wasn't what you were suggesting, Tracy, but they can't do that because then those people will say, "Oh, that's the fourth one. I got to get the first one and the second one and the third one before I get that one." So they have to call it something all new.
Yeah, well, I guess I just fall under the belief that if you call something a new start point, and that if the product has changed so essentially from the original that, you know, the rules that are going to be published in it are different than the rule are drastically different than the rules that are published in the original, including, you know, character powers, the way dailies work, and common rules such as stealth or movement and that kind of stuff, that to me that it's just a different version. It's just a little different.
But wait, is stealth really different? I mean, it's not. It's different from the PHB 1, but we're all using the new updated stealth anyway, so it's not different.
But that's what I've been saying, is that we're all used to using it because we play with the updates months at a time. They give us updates, and then we play with them, and then they give us more updates, and we play with them. I'm just saying they've learned their lesson from, you know, the all-at-once 3.0 to 3.5 update. And they've given us everything slowly over time. And they've built us into a new system to the point where we won't be mad if things change a little bit because we've already been playing with a lot of it.
I think we've been playing with service packs, not necessarily version updates.
Even a service pack can be looked at as, you know, you've got Windows Vista 1.0 or you've got Windows Vista Service Pack 2, which is
Either way you look at it, you've still got Windows Vista. And that's the important thing that I think they're trying to emphasize that it's not a new version, it's still 4th edition.
Right.
I think it's a matter of marketing. And we're not even the market. I think that the quote-unquote compatibility issue is being focused on. I think it's being focused on those new players who don't want to buy a product and go, "Hey, this is great, but I can't use it with the stuff that's already out there."
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's what I think that the compatibility. I think there is an element of everybody going, "Well, we want to avoid that 3 to 3.5 issue, so we want to make sure all the old people, the veteran players, know that they can still use everything, but we also want to make sure the new people know that they're not buying a standalone game, they're buying an entrance to everything that's already been made available."
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think this is something that we're going to come to terms on.
No, we're not going to solve it tonight.
Yeah,
but
it's just, and we don't have the information required. We don't know exactly what they're going to release you know, what the product's going to look like until the product is actually released. So this is just one of those things that each of us has our own view on the subject, and each of us is just going to have to continue to have our own view.
Yeah, I mean, we'll find out more in a month at Gen Con when people get experience. If it's true that the D&D Essentials is being run for the new gamers, then we'll have a better idea just from that. I mean, Tracy can tell us directly how big the differences are and if it really does feel like a new edition. And I'm sure they'll have more information even beyond that at Gen Con. And, you know, both you and I are going to PAX, and I'm sure they'll have it there. You know, Thaddeus, we can try it out ourselves.
Yep.
So,
but
go ahead.
As far as, you know, we're all concerned, I think we've been going at this for almost 2 hours now, so now is definitely a good time for everybody to say goodnight.
Well, I was going to bring up one more small topic before we
head out. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And what does everyone think about the dungeon mastering going up on the block?
Okay. Oh, good night, everybody. Good.
Yeah. We can't talk about that.
That's something.
That's a topic, I'm afraid.
We can't talk about it.
Sorry. Yeah. I can't. I'm a little invested in that right now, so I can't actually say anything about it.
Yeah, as much as I'd like to, I don't think we really should.
Yeah,
that may be something.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a topic in and of
you know
itself.
What, no,
so
you know what
that is?
You know what, Randall? I'll send you an email or a direct message afterwards telling you why. But
and we can talk about it once the whole sale of the website's gone down, and then we will all you know, we'll all be on one side of the issue or another by the time it goes down. So
yeah,
okay.
All right. No, I was just interested in what the thoughts were, so
We'll give you those offline.
It's not a problem. Yeah.
All right. Hey Cato Catonian, are you there?
He went to sleep.
Good night.
I was reading Mike's book.
Now we just wanted to say good night.
You guys are going already? You're leaving me all alone?
Yeah, well, you're not even listening anymore. You're reading. I mean, we must have become boring at some point. So that's when it's time to call it the end. So,
but I want to know what happened to dungeonmastering.com.
Well, not until next time. You'll find out on the next podcast.
Damn it!
Gives people the chance to tune in next time and find out.
That's true.
We leave you all on a cliffhanger, thanks to
with Randall. A cliffhanger. That's right. Yep. That's right. All right. Great discussion tonight, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks again to Mike for showing up too. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Even though we passed his bedtime, it was great that he came. And dude's really smart, especially when it comes to D&D. Guys got it going on. He's almost as smart as I am. I really like having him around.
Very savvy. Yeah. All right, guys.
All right. Peace out, everybody.
See you later. Good night,
everybody.
Until the next time.
Yep.
Good night.
Good night, John boy.
So anyone want to stay on and trash talk for a while?
Yeah, hold up.
Well, I need you to get off so I can trash talk. Yeah,